Since the invention of the wheel, automation has both substituted and complemented labor. Machines replaced humans at some lower-paying jobs, but this was compensated by the creation of new, higher-paying jobs. In other words, tech workers. In recent years, there has been a desire from certain high-profile tech companies for an apolitical workplace. This in itself is a political act, an act designed to suppress the power of tech workers and reinforce the status quo. They know that politics is inextricable from tech, and now, so do you. Welcome to Politics. Ray, I think we should talk about some narratives and narrators.
Yeah, I completely agree. The narrative has sort of changed recently, hasn't it, about AI, because I think that there are essentially like two, three, four, five camps of AIs. You've got essentially the main people you have with AI. You have AI boosters or AI doomers. That's the sort of projected narrative that we have.
Right.
I think we can go on to the fact that there's actually a spectrum of narratives here and possibilities here. But the main kind of the dominant narratives are boosters and doomers. And
right.
The doomers basically say, we've let loose Pandora's box. It doesn't matter what we do now. It's too late. Even if we were to try and stop research, it's too late. There's an arms race going on between the various superpowers, which is just inevitable now that we will create the artificial general intelligence. And because we create the artificial general intelligence, that will automatically create an automatic superintelligence.
Right.
Then the question is, whether that automatic superintelligence, which is super because it's beyond us. AGI is kind of human level intelligence. It can do everything we can do and more. But superintelligence is 1,000x more powerful and, you know, exponentially more powerful than we are. It will dominate us like we dominate the bees or something like that.
Ants, they love to use the ant thing, right? So artificial superintelligence is to us as we are to ants. It's really good that you've kind of nailed the doomer versus booster narrative. And as you say, we're starting to shift away from that. But it's very interesting if we look at the doomers, that the doomer narrative is that the path is from artificial narrow intelligence, which is where we are today, to artificial general intelligence, the human level intelligence, to artificial super intelligence due to, as soon as we hit AGI, then they're saying the intelligence increases exponentially, right?
Yes.
Meaning it doubles every, you know, just pick a time unit, doubles every 4 months, doubles every 18 months. But the point is that this exponential growth curve soon takes it orders of magnitude higher than human intelligence, at which point we encounter a singularity, right? A point where everything changes to the extent that it's impossible to predict what comes next. So this is the stock doomer narrative. And then, as you said, this superintelligence could be beneficial or it could be oppressive.
Yeah.
That's that narrative. And before we move on to how this narrative is changing into something different, I think it's important to know that sometimes people like you and me who are pointing to actually existing problems, not theoretical ones, but actually existing problems, sometimes we're kind of lumped in with doomers. And I think we have to push back and make a distinction there. We are critics, not doomers.
Yes, yes, that's exactly right. Yeah, I mean, I think there's a distinction between being critical of the current and potential uses of the existing technology.
Yeah.
We know the technology will be refined in some way. Maybe some of the ergonomics, some of the usage patterns will be simplified or made more generally available. And I think, you know, we can definitely perceive that. That's happening already.
Yeah, absolutely.
That makes a lot of sense that those things will become easier and more accessible to use. But the fact that they're broadly applied and they're accessible does not make them good.
Right, right. Yeah.
It does not make them, it does not even make them useful,
no,
you
true.
Know? So we can discuss like the use cases and all that kind of stuff of the existing technology, but do we want to stick on the doomerism for a little bit longer? Because I think there are some interesting aspects about what's driving the most powerful people in the world
right.
to
right.
potentially, and also the people who have, you know, Hinton and co, who are like the godfathers of AI, and various people thinking about this. And then you have like philosophers like Nick Bostrom.
Oh God.
Talking about like,
let me spit on the floor when you say his name. Yeah.
Well, yeah. but he's getting, you know, a lot of, there's a lot of attention from other thinkers, you know, such as Peter Thiel and Elon Musk, about what it means to have this artificial superintelligence. And there's a whole movement behind this, which is bound up in all kinds of strange futuristic philosophies to do with...
Right. Tescreals, right?
Tescreal, yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know what all those initials stand for off the top of my head. We can look it up. But I mean, basically, the main idea is that somehow in this artificial superintelligence world, we as humans will be kind of uploaded into or merged with, in the benign scenarios, we will be merged or incorporated into the machines, and then we'll be reproduced because these machines will discover the solutions to all kinds of resource problems that we're too dumb to think about. We actually know the answers already, but leave that to one side. We know exactly what the answers are. So these things will come up with better answers, let's say, answers that suit the increased resource usage that they require.
Yeah.
So they'll come up with better answers, and then they will go on interplanetary missions to populate the universe with trillions of human beings.
Right.
And this is a completely bizarre, strange concept.
Right. Long-termism, yeah.
But that's giving it too much credibility. That's the name of it. If we spit on the people's names, we should definitely spit on the concept of that. Because the reason why long-termism is a huge problem is because it's set up to explicitly denigrate and reduce the priority of existing problems. You know, that's why I'm interested in that, in just staying there a bit, because it's used as an argument to say, oh, it doesn't matter what is happening now to the 8 billion people that are here. We need to care about the trillions of people that a future universe will accommodate.
Exactly.
And it's a very bizarre argument. I think as human beings, we do want to care about our children, you know? And maybe it's our children's children, because we can see our grandchildren and our great-grandchildren even, maybe. But are our actions or our sort of policies now thinking about people in a million years? I don't think so. I think we want to think about it in a few generations. We want to perceive, well, you know, what can we do in our lifetime, in our children? How can we enable future generations? But our sort of horizon is maybe 100 years, maybe it's, I think that's already like very, very high.
Right.
You see what I'm getting at is that, you know, we want to concern ourselves with these near-term things, but this long-termism basically gives an excuse to say, actually, all of those things are irrelevant and small potatoes compared to the future civilization that this artificial superintelligence will engender.
Right. That's the Tescreal stuff, right? Which is stands for transhumanism, extropianism, singularityism, cosmism, rationalism, effective altruism, and long-termism. So this was Timnit Gebru and Emil Torres.
Yeah.
So they coined this phrase. And if you want to deep dive into this stuff, Emil Torres hosts a podcast with a comedian named Kate Willett called Dystopia Now. And they have an episode where they break down the acronym Tescreal and explain the different parts and how they fit together. You actually knitted together a lot of these things in what you were talking about.
Yeah.
So you nailed the transhumanism, right? Because we upload ourselves to the cloud, and that's how we get to be trillions of people. It's the long-termism and cosmism, because we're in the sky and it's millions of years in the future. This effective altruistic argument is the one that says that we must do the greatest amount of good for the greatest amount of people, and the ends always justify the means, and we're talking about the trillions of people in the future, therefore, like you said, the 8 billion don't matter. Well, okay, the 8 billion don't matter with an exception, right? Those people who are smart enough to amass great resources so they can effectively, altruistically help these theoretical future people, trillions of virtual people, millions of years in the future. So I think like this narrative is very self-serving of the tech elites, right? Because they have this, they've convinced themselves that this is a meritocracy. And since they are the ones ruling the world, they are the ones with the most merit in the world. Mm. Therefore, they are uniquely suited to make decisions about resource allocation.
Yes. Moreover, I feel like they feel that if they're not in charge and they don't have that power, that they won't be able to outpace the crises, the polycrisis. I think what Emil Torres calls the, people call it the polycrisis, and he says that we're super fucked. And I think that's a great way of putting it, you know? So,
yeah. Like,
anyway, he's great. But the point is that these people think that they can outrun the technology and outrun the crisis, especially. They control the technology and they can outrun the crisis. So if we've got like a crisis of inequality, it's not a crisis for them. They're on the other side of that crisis.
Right.
If we've got a crisis of climate change, most estimates are that it will wipe out half the people on the planet.
Sure.
Now, it's going to probably wipe out the southern half, you know, where most people live.
Right. The global south. Yeah. Yeah.
The global south. That's where it'll be mostly affected. And so, again, those people feel like they can outrun this crisis. They will survive the crisis and their children will survive the crisis.
Yeah, they have their fortresses in New Zealand and so on.
Yeah, they have their fortresses.
Right? Their mercenary armies, which is not a joke.
They
literally do. Peter Thiel and co.
Yeah. And the other thing that they're keen on is this, like, and I didn't really understand this until recently, was this pronatalist movement.
Yes. Elon Musk, a big proponent.
Where they want to make sure that they and their progeny, as many as possible of their progeny, are the ones that are filling up the earth.
Exactly.
And this is very, very like fascistic.
Yeah, it's replacement theory.
Scary kind of thinking where, you know, Elon Musk is having 15, 20 kids only because he believes that his genes in some way form the basis of his superiority.
Exactly. The Telegram founder, one of the founders of Telegram, the instant messaging service, apparently has 100 children.
Right, okay.
But it's the same idea. Like, again, the people who have risen to the top of the meritocracy, clearly they need to reproduce. And it's just amazing. Like, these elites are so concerned with birth rates, right? And they usually don't say the second part out loud, which is we want the poors to, you know, have fewer children.
Yes.
And we want the riches, you know, the elites to have more. And
yes,
this is straight up replacement theory, right? It's the same shit as Hitler was
straight
preaching.
Eugenics.
You know, yeah, exactly. Pronatalism leads inevitably and very directly to eugenics, right? And we're starting to even hear this pro-eugenics language come back into vogue. You know, race science is making a return.
Yeah, definitely. And we can reference a whole bunch of people that are doing this, like Douglas Murray, the bell curve, all this kind of stuff, to try and legitimize this stuff. And he is being, as you say, he's being brought into the mainstream.
Yeah, again. Right. The bell curve was like a big thing when it came out in the late 80s or early 90s.
Yeah.
It was then quickly discredited.
Yeah.
And he kind of slunk out of the spotlight for a while. And now he's being dragged back in by his billionaire buddies.
Yeah. I mean, it really is a horror movie, isn't it? You know, these fuckers won't die. You know, just keep on jump scaring us.
The sequel. Exactly. The bell curve rings again.
So yeah, I mean, I think those are all the kind of, like, if we go back to this generic thing of, because funnily enough, these people, although they're kind of doomers, they're also boosters, you know.
Yeah,
they're seeing these are the sort of positive outcomes,
right?
You know,
right,
where we do end up becoming part of this super intelligence, this long-term uploading into the machine.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, again, it's a sort of bizarre idea.
Yeah.
But the main reason, as you said, just to sort of like regroup on that, that's what justifies them controlling a large amount of resources and a large amount of technology.
Exactly.
That's the key narrative here that they're pushing,
yeah,
is that definitely they need to maintain that amount of control so that they can do this. From my perspective, I would say those narratives are a useful distraction.
Yeah.
They're basically another way of holding on to those resources and legitimizing their control of those resources.
Absolutely.
But they seem like complete fantasy. And you can have very clever people with, you know, very highly accredited degrees from highly respected universities saying all of this stuff.
Yeah.
But frankly, it doesn't cut the mustard in terms of any materialist analysis, any kind of understanding of how the world works today.
Yeah.
This is a pure fantasy. And these people might be, you know, on some metric very, very smart, but they're saying stuff which is being, I would say, co-opted by the rich and powerful to justify their own current actions and their current resource hoarding.
Yeah, I mean, co-opted in some cases, actively encouraged or financially supported in others.
Mm.
I totally agree with you. And I'm sure some of these people do believe some of their own bullshit. Everybody wants to be the hero of their own story. Yeah. Everyone wants to find justifications. And everybody really wants to believe in those justifications so that they're not the asshole that everybody thinks they are, right? Elon Musk wants so badly to be loved. Like, you can see it. You can see it in his every interview.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We can love him, but we don't have to love what he does.
Well, I don't even love him, so maybe.
No, I don't love him, but I think we talked about this before in terms of rules of engagement, you know. I don't want to dehumanize Elon Musk.
Sure.
But I do want to be very critical of his actions and of his resource hoarding.
Yeah.
But obviously his narratives and his actions and his behavior is extremely dangerous, basically. That's
right.
Fundamentally true. But anyway, let's get back to narratives rather than people, because I think what we want to talk about is, like, what are the things which are sent to scare us, which are sent mm-hmm. to tell us about artificial intelligence. So we've covered this, like, doomerism thing where artificial intelligence becomes this superintelligence, and it's either going to destroy us. That's one option. If we're not aligned to it, and the clever people need to stay in charge to keep us aligned.
Right.
That's the kind of, like, through line there. And God knows how they think that they're, like, able to wrestle with this superintelligence. The rest of us aren't. It's all fan fiction, so we can take it as read that they're going to do something brilliant.
Right.
Oh, that's what they think.
Yeah.
So that's the sort of either, like, super utopian or super dystopian future with this artificial superintelligence.
Right.
But then there are other things that this superintelligence is going to do. Or this artificial general intelligence is going to do, which is, like you mentioned, it was going to solve climate change.
Right.
What's that all about? You know, how is that going to work?
I mentioned the word exponential before, right? And I want to bring us back to exponential, because their explanation is that somehow the artificial narrow intelligence that we have today, LLMs, somehow this becomes artificial general intelligence, right? Through some combination of, like, we make a technical breakthrough and the just evolution of this technology. So I would say, like, the people who know the most about the technology are the ones who are putting the least amount of credence into LLMs evolve into AGI. Whereas people who don't know the technology, they're like, oh my God, obviously ChatGPT will become sentient. But for AGI to make the leap into ASI, so general intelligence, human level, to become super intelligent God, that relies on this exponential growth of intelligence. Hmm. And what we know is that will also require an exponential increase in resource usage, right?
Right.
In power generation and data center capacity. And right now, we can't bring that amount of power generation online quickly enough to keep up with the exponential growth curve. Therefore, the AGI or ASI has to solve, you know, renewable power. It has to.
Oh, nuclear fusion.
Nuclear fusion, right? Yeah. Cold fusion, which has been 10 years away or 5 years away for the last half century or something.
Hmm.
So yeah, cold fusion is the thing that they usually point to, right? So this is a self-perpetuating narrative. In order for this to be credible at all, you need this exponential growth. And the only way to achieve this exponential growth in resource usage is for the AI itself to solve that problem. So that's where this nonsense comes from, because there's no other way. Mm-hmm. And I think it's interesting too, like speaking of a materialist analysis, who are the people saying this? When are they saying it? And what's motivating? One of the people I'll point to is Sam Altman. He's the CEO and co-founder of OpenAI. Mm-hmm. The other co-founder was Elon Musk. And just to take it back to the narrative, like you said, these are the people who say AGI is inevitable and it's super dangerous. So it has to be us, the ethical people who developed this technology. That was OpenAI, right? Yeah. It was founded as a nonprofit with the mission of developing AGI that won't kill us all or whatever, right?
Right.
OpenAI then has evolved into a product company. And it's evolved into like basically a company that needs to keep the hype alive in order to attract the venture capital investments that are required, because they've built a product that is unsustainably, like, it's losing money at an unsustainable pace,
yes,
right?
Yes.
So OpenAI goes through these cycles of launching a new version of ChatGPT and talking about how amazing it is, what an incredible advance. And then they kind of stop talking about that, and Sam Altman comes out and talks about how scary AGI is and whatever. The reason he does that is because they are currently starting to raise money for their next round. So he really needs to reinflate this kind of techno-utopian, long-termist doomerism. Like, we're calling it doomerism, but it's either utopianism or doomerism. But, you know, it's maybe inevitabilism is a better word. But
inevitability, I think, is a great word for it, though. I think that is the...
Yeah.
That we can come on to inevitability in a minute, I think.
Why don't we launch into it right now? So,
okay, well,
inevitability.
No, I want this, because your narrative is about like the. It's very interesting that your narrative is saying that he's using these stories to drive fundraising.
Yeah,
and the other thing that's, I think, before we come on to inevitability is the other narrative that seems to be getting set up is this oppositional narrative, this narrative of an arms race, of
right.
a war.
Yes.
And I think this is a very important narrative to talk about, because that's not how I see it, but that's definitely how it's being phrased.
Yeah.
It was pretty clear when DeepSeek came out end of last year.
Beginning of this.
Yeah, so fairly recently. So I think they had some models last year, but anyway, I think the
paper came out in January.
Yeah. The big disturbance was this year, yeah. Yeah, so DeepSeek come out. DeepSeek is research laboratory for a private equity firm,
exactly.
or some sort of venture capitalist company, some sort of...
No, it's a private equity firm, yeah.
It's a private equity firm in China, yeah. This research lab who are doing AI research, they're looking at what OpenAI are doing. They're looking at their benchmarks and all this kind of stuff. And we know that the American government, not Trump, this is Biden, he reduced the availability of certain chips to certain countries. And one of those countries was China. And so they didn't get all of the advanced chips that OpenAI got. And this is something which, because I think we should come on to the J.D. Vance narrative as well.
Yes.
In a minute. But let's talk about what DeepSeek was first. So DeepSeek came out and they said, actually, we've got as good results as OpenAI's models, and sometimes better than OpenAI models,
yep.
with less resources, with weaker chips. And it was like, it was, you know, we saw in the stock market that their valuations tanked.
NVIDIA and OpenAI, yeah.
Yeah. And they've since sort of like climbed back. Because of
reasons, yes.
We can come on to various reasons. Because of this war narrative, I would say.
Yeah.
You know?
100%.
This is kind of like a strange concept of a war, because this was just another group of people, another group of researchers.
Yeah.
Okay, it was in China, but they'd done some amazing stuff. They were using less resources. It should have been, you know, a round of applause all round. And let's see how we can work together, like International Space Station
right.
type of thing, you know?
Yeah. This is how science is supposed to work, right?
This is how science is supposed to work.
OpenAI publishes their results, which of course they try not to as much as possible while still maintaining the veneer of some nonprofit, you know, for the good of humankind.
Yeah. But they based their model on the Facebook Llama, if I'm not wrong. Yeah.
Exactly. So then DeepSeek comes along, looks at their results, does some research, and the breakthrough there is they were able to train their model and, like you said, get comparable results, you know, a little better in some cases, a little worse than others, but comparable at a training cost of two orders of magnitude less, right?
Yes.
So they trained it for on the order of 10 million. And OpenAI trains the latest version of ChatGPT, I think, costs close to $1 billion to train, certainly in the high hundreds of millions.
Yeah.
So that's science, right?
And that's great, you know? If we ever want to say that artificial intelligence is useful for something, then having it cost less to be made and to run seems like a good thing.
Yes.
That seems like a really good thing.
Yeah, but that's counter to their narrative of the way to fix the problems with AI is to scale it up. That's how we fix things.
Yeah. And I think most of the narrative now is about, well, DeepSeek was pretty good for like a desktop, but does it scale out to enterprise-wide stuff? Right. I mean, come on, you know.
This is
absolute, scare quotes for real there. You know, this is like, again, total nonsense that it's just we've got to keep you know using more water, burning more fuel, and you know keep the data centers growing. It doesn't matter what these DeepSeek guys are doing.
Right.
But the main point was that DeepSeek came from China. OpenAI is an American company.
Yep.
We've now got a very kind of, I think American politics has changed to be very America first. It changed in the first Trump term, and probably even before then. But certainly Joe Biden was America first, not necessarily using those terms, but he was all about reshoring manufacturing and all this and putting tariffs on China and reduce. Like we said, the Biden was responsible for this chip, the reduction in the availability of chips to China. So that narrative has been going on now for at least 10, possibly 15 years in America. Mm-hmm. So now we're seeing, like, because we saw DeepSeek doing better than American companies on weaker technology, it was felt by those industry leaders to be a shot across the bows.
Yeah, absolutely.
And why was that? Well, because it hurt them in the most dangerous place possible in their stock market valuations.
Yeah, exactly.
So it wasn't just a shot to their pride. It was a shot to their actual wealth and their credibility as well. I personally feel like their credibility is definitely remains low and lowered because of that, but somehow, because they've got this big machine, this big PR machine, they're maintaining this hype factor.
Yeah.
That's an important thing, that it's not really a war in any kind of meaningful sense. There's no concept of a war here.
Yeah.
But again, coming to the doomerist perspective, if China somehow get a higher form of artificial intelligence than America gets, then this is going to be a problem. And now we can come on to the J.D. Vance Security Summit narratives.
100%. When we say the J.D. Vance Security Summit, so J.D. Vance made a trip to Europe about a month ago, as of this recording, I suppose, and effectively told, and I'm going to summarize, he said, hands off AI Europe. We're going to do this in the U.S. and you all need to get in line. Otherwise, China is going to destroy us all or whatever, more or less.
The other thing that was really important was he was saying that the true enemy of the future is essentially tech regulation.
Yes.
You know, he called it the enemy within, And he was going on about a whole bunch of stuff to do with prayers and stuff like this. But essentially, he was saying that Europe was overregulating American companies, right, and that they should not do this with AI. And we now see that in America, even internally in America, they don't want states to regulate AI.
Right. And by states, they mean California, basically.
By states, they mean California. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Because there is maybe it's New York as well.
Maybe, yeah.
But, you know, definitely California in terms of like California is already, and then various other states are proposing some kind of measure to hold people accountable for artificial intelligence and any kind of legislation that blocks the adoption of any automated technology is going to be outlawed. This seems incredibly strange, given the generic perspective on the right wing of American politics that states' rights are the greatest, you know, that you should allow states. I think we all know that it's...
Cynical.
It's fairly cynical. It's okay, what suits our needs right now?
Exactly.
We'll use that argument to suit this particular situation. And then this other situation, there's no principle, basically.
No.
It's all just case-by-case basis that suits their particular needs rather than any kind of principled stand on these things. There's a lot of nonsense talked about principles, especially in the Supreme Court, but in fact, most of it's quite cynical.
Yeah, definitely.
I don't think that's my own perspective. That's proven by their flip-flopping around this concept of states' rights versus federalism.
Yeah, the whole states' rights movement was born to combat segregation, right?
Yeah.
Where the federal government told southern states that you cannot segregate. Mm. And, you know, all of a sudden, these powerful figures, and in the beginning, you know, these were the so-called Southern Democrats. So they were called Democrat, but they were, you know, right wing. So whether you call the party Republican or Democrat, in the U.S., I think it's the important distinction is the one you made. It's a right-wing tactic to center states' rights, because so far they've been concentrating on the rights of certain states to do things such as outlaw abortion or segregate schools and all of these things. But all of a sudden, like you said, when they're worried about a state like California, which is the world's fifth largest economy, passing a regulation limiting AI, and for people who don't know, California passed strong automotive emissions regulations in the late 80s to combat the smog problem. And what that effectively did is it set de facto U.S. national regulations on tailpipe emissions because California was such a huge market that every car company, you know, they didn't want to make the California model and the rest of the world model or the rest of the US model. And in the same way, like this would be a real constraint on the AI companies, most of which are based in California. Mm-hmm. If all of a sudden they had to like detect California and do certain things and then for the rest of the world, just whatever.
Yeah. This narrative that is coming from essentially tech leaders, industrial leaders, and politicians at the top of the American state is all essentially about protecting AI and growing the AI base. That to me feels like it's a raw power situation, essentially. Right. I don't think we can really phrase it in any other way other than a raw power move.
Yep.
We can go into the sort of fascistic aspect of it that we mentioned earlier on, but fundamentally it's a move of raw power.
Yeah, definitely.
We want to keep what we've got and we want to grow our money pot. And AI is seen, for the moment at least, to be a vehicle for that.
Yeah. And like you said, that's a raw power move, a hard power move. But I really want to get into the soft power aspects of this. And I think there we've talked about doomers. Hmm. Let's talk about the booster angle. Like, who are the boosters?
Yes.
What do they want? And I think maybe a really good place to start on the boosters is you sent me a link to a podcast episode of this, what's it called? Diary of a CEO with Stephen Bartless.
Yes.
And this episode is titled, all caps, AI agents emergency debate.
Yes.
And so the host, this guy, Stephen Bartless, has on, I think, three guests to talk about all of these jobs are going to disappear, but this is actually a great thing. And we'll tell you why effectively, right? And so these people, two of the guests were CEOs, one of them of the company Replit. Another one was the CEO of some other company. And then the third was an evolutionary biologist slash complex systems thinker. And what struck me listening to this is you have two boosters on there, the CEOs, and you have a kind of doomer in this evolutionary biologist guy. And the arguments of the boosters were just infuriating, mostly nonsensical stuff based on, at best, their lived experience as, you know, people in a highly privileged position. Whereas this doomer, his arguments were, I mean, this guy has a background in complex systems theory, and a lot of his arguments were really, really good. They were sound, they were logically flowing, and they were also built on a ridiculous assumption. And so, you know, I found this so frustrating, and we'll put it in the show notes, but let me toss it to you now. And like, what are the boosters saying? What are the booster narratives? And why in the hell are people boosting this stuff? What's going on?
It was a very interesting debate. This guy, Stephen Bartlett, is a relatively young guy. He is like, I don't know, he has like internet businesses and...
He's a hustler.
He's a hustler, yeah. He's a rise and grinder. He really is.
He is grinding.
And, you know, again, I think a lot of people in his situation, he's a CEO, so it's really three CEOs, and then this guy, Brett Weinstein, who people may have heard of. It's a bit of a, he's an interesting character, let's say. They're all basically saying, this is fantastic. This AI is awesome. It's going to get us somewhere brilliant, but we have some concerns. We have some worries, Brett Weinstein is basically saying, I see all the great things, but I also see 10x the bad things.
Yeah.
That was the essential. If we cut it down to the nub of the discussion, it was, they were all, this is fantastic.
Yeah.
And he was all, this probably is fantastic in the short term, but long term, it's pretty horrible.
Exactly. So exactly what he said is there are infinite positive applications or infinite beneficial applications of their stuff.
Oh, yeah.
And infinite, there are 10x.
10 times infinite.
10 times infinite. Okay.
Very dorm room. Yeah, that's
exactly.
Right. Okay, but leaving aside some of these like these tiny, tiny sort of criticisms, essentially he was saying that it might get good, but it's also going to get really, really bad.
Yeah.
Because for every good thing that you can see that AI will bring, there will be people who want to abuse it, people who want to make all the things that you see as being very positive in time saving and stuff like this and production of, you know, podcasts or production of companies even, you know, production of applications. You know, people can also produce bad art, bad simulations, bad podcasts, bad stuff. I get it. You know, they're talking about like, let's say a more near-term arms race where bad actors can take advantage of this technology. And Brett Weinstein is basically saying that can escalate and escalate. You know, the more and more, you're always going to have this battle between the good and the bad, essentially, the good angels and the bad angels in humanity.
Exactly.
Which is, you know, okay, fair enough. That's we know that in terms of, you know, cybercrime and stuff like this, it's a reality.
Yeah.
And there are people, you know, calling old ladies up and calling, you know, essentially to try and cheat them out of their money. So this is real.
Yeah. And it's interesting because even in that episode, Stephen Bartless himself was talking about how now he has on LinkedIn or whatever, weekly he has to deal with some deep fake generated of him.
Right.
Invest $100 in this, and then somebody emailing him and being like, oh my God, I got scammed and I thought it was you. And So, you know, they're kind of acknowledging these bad things, but the core of their kind of boosterous narrative there is they were talking specifically about AI agents, right? Mm. So what we have now, we have a ChatGPT is a chatbot, right? It sits there and it answers questions. But the difference between that and an AI agent is an AI agent you give instructions to. It goes out and does a thing for you and then comes back to you when that task is complete.
Yeah.
And so what they were saying is like, oh my God, this gives smart people incredible leverage. And they were talking about the scenario in which I can actually tell my agent or fleet of agents, swarm of agents, monitor the World Wide Web, the internets, for good business opportunities, then create a software business around this and report back to me, right? They were saying things like, I could generate 10 companies a day, you know, with this approach. Or, okay, maybe I'm the big brain that has the idea. All I have to do is tell the AI, make this idea a reality. So not only write the software, but also register the company in a tax haven, create my marketing materials, you know, my videos, all of this. So what they were saying, and again, that they saw this as an incredibly positive thing. And they only admitted the potential for abuse when the biologist guy like was like, yeah, but what about? And then they were like, oh, okay, of course, obviously. And that's happening today. And it's the usual kind of thing where they just want to hand wave what's happening today and really talk about, oh, but look at this bright tomorrow.
Yeah.
And so one assertion they made is that, and I want to make the point about privilege and perspective. So what these people said is, this is the great leveler. This is democratizing AI. And that's another narrative they like to use, right? I think OpenAI has it in their mission statement. You know, we're democratizing this. And by that, they mean putting it in the hands of the demos, the people. And what these boosters were saying is like, this makes every single person on Earth equal all of a sudden. Now, any smart person anywhere on the planet has $20 technology that can create a multi-million dollar business, right? Whatever. And they said this thing with a straight face.
I know. This is really crazy to me that they think that this is real. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't have the statistics right in front of me, Ray, but out of the 8 billion people on the planet, what percent of those do you think have a reliable internet connection? And let's be super generous and say you could really do this for $20, which you can't. But out of that, you know, 8 billion people on the planet, what percentage have both a reliable internet connection and $20 to spend on this?
Yeah, let's say 10%.
Yeah.
Yeah.
10%, 20 if we're being super duper generous. So how does this make us all equals? How is this technology going to save mankind? It's not. It's going to save the top 10 to 20%, and that's all they care about.
Yeah, but I don't even think that, I mean, even if you imagine, like let's even be generous and say it was half the population of the Earth. So it's like 4 billion people.
Right, because climate change will kill the other half.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Okay. So we're already enjoying the future. Yeah. Yeah. So we're down to 4 billion, yeah? But this idea that it's a kind of strange capitalist idea or strange idea that these people have that everyone can do it. And it's,
exactly.
I think it's a kind of, what should we call it, a survivor bias. They've somehow got themselves, like rise and grinding, you know, whatever, grifting, whatever you want to call it, into some...
Hashtag hustle culture, yes.
Hashtag hustle culture, yeah. I'm not going to say it's theft, but for me, it's not far away from theft, what they're doing.
Yeah.
But okay, let's leave that to one side for the moment.
Yeah. And they even, I mean, just really quickly on the theft point, they even acknowledged that. One of them said, yeah, but hey, if you have your bot, if you have your agent, sorry, scanning the internet for good ideas and then making business, aren't you stealing the ideas? So even they were like, yeah, so it's a little bit theft.
I know. Well, but they are rising grinders. They are scammers. They are, I mean.
Yeah, they don't give a shit.
I think one of the reasons why Stephen Bartlett is getting these calls from people saying, I was conned out of this money, is because he kind of presents as a bit of a scammer.
Yeah.
You know, he presents as a bit of a advice giver who will tell you to give money here and give money there.
I mean, the whole self-help industry, of which these kind of YouTubers and hustle culturers are just the most modern incarnation of.
Yeah.
That whole thing is based on, like, I can show you how to do this for yourself.
It's a greater fool theory, fundamentally. Yeah.
You need to give me a little money to get started, a little seed money. But then...
It's the greater fool theory always, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Exactly. You and me, we know how to make money, and these poor fools will give it to us. So, and that's why I consider it to be theft in that sense, is that they're almost explicitly trying to arbitrage access to some sort of knowledge. And this, by the way, I think a lot of that is the basis of all of this stuff with AI.
Yeah.
If we really want to, like, bottom it all out, that's what it all is, you know, knowledge arbitrage. So, okay, so these guys are talking about all this stuff and saying that they can make these businesses. But again, you know, we all know in a capitalist world that even if we were to grant in the steel man argument that this was a meritocracy and that everyone who had access to it could make these businesses, then they would make these people's businesses completely redundant, obviously very quickly. You know, they would wipe them out pretty quickly.
Right. Right.
And they would wipe out all of the businesses very quickly. And yet somehow companies like IBM, Microsoft, Google don't get wiped out by other capitalists. And so there is a reason for this. It's not an accident. This idea that everyone in the world, given access to this stuff, could produce all these companies is in itself obviously a fantasy.
Yeah.
Because the way that capitalist societies work is that there's always going to be some imbalance between the owners of the means of production and the people that are actually producing things. I think the biggest concern, the real big concern, is who's going to buy our stuff?
Right.
If everyone is like out of work, if everyone is like becomes unemployable because all of these AIs are all PhD level people, and they're living in this data center somewhere, there's billions of these PhD level people that I can employ for $20 an hour, a month or whatever. Well, what happens to all of the service industry? What happens to all of these people? They all become poor.
Right.
And then you get into this whole, maybe we do need to give some money to the poor after all.
Yeah, universal basic income. They love that stuff. So I think that's a really interesting one. This universal basic income thing, like, it came up, I think, Andrew Young in the United States kind of brought it into the public imagination during his presidential campaign. And then Sam Altman, it turns out, so again, the co-founder of OpenAI, also has founded another company, which I believe is a nonprofit, and their mission is to bring a global universal basic income. So again, like, why are all of these AI people suddenly talking about UBI? And why are they so excited about AI agents? And why are they constantly pushing this narrative of AI will make all knowledge jobs redundant? And why are, you know, your Microsofts and OpenAIs and so on, why are they pushing these enterprise AI tools? Why, Ray? Why?
Why? Yeah, I think it's fundamentally because they want to cut costs and they want to increase their profit margins.
Yeah.
We are in a world where, like, companies do want to cut costs and increase profits. And this is where another arms race comes from again, is that if you're a company that is looking to cut costs, if you're not using all of the technology that you can or all of the kind of, like, imagination, innovation to cut the costs, then you're essentially putting yourself outside of the system.
Exactly.
I think they mentioned the Amish or something, you know.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, you know, that this is the concept that, you know, if you're not with us, you're kind of outside of the system, which I think is a false dichotomy. But anyway, the general idea is that if we don't do it, somebody else will, and then they will basically buy our company.
Right, right.
And then we'll be forced to do it anyway.
Exactly, exactly.
So I think this is the logical argument, is not even about profits to some extent. It's about survivalism. Mm-hmm. It's about saying that, yeah, we will happen to make more profits, but we're only doing that in order to make sure that we're competitive.
Yeah. And I mean, again, I think that's a justification. And I think this is where the universal basic income thing comes from, because like they realize what they're saying is we are going to put all workers out of a job. And under the rules of the system we live in, the agreement we make is that we work or we die, right?
Yeah.
We must work to generate the money that we need to pay for the things that sustain life. So even the capitalists realize that effectively what they're saying is if they put everyone out of work, that's a death sentence. And so, holy shit, oops, like we can't take the mask off that far, right? You know, that's a little bit too much of the quiet part that we accidentally said out loud. So universal basic income and, you know, this idea, again, this is a techno-utopist idea that all work will be removed, leaving time for humans to have a meaningful life, right?
Right.
But if we look at what automation really does, again, like, and I think we can trace a straight thread, I guess pun fully intended, from the original Luddites, the weavers who were smashing the automated looms, to modern day critics of this AI technology, because it's all about exerting control over workers. It's all about basically having the automation, okay, it's eliminating some jobs, and the jobs that are left are less fulfilling, less skilled, right? You're effectively feeding parts into the machine.
Yes.
The factory system, for example, like no longer do you need artisans, but what you need is people standing on a conveyor belt doing a specialized task that's too expensive to automate, while the automation, you know, handles all the rest. So this is, you know, the famous quote about we'll have whatever it is, millions of people screwing the little tiny screws into the iPhones. That's how we'll reshore iPhone manufacturing. So it's about reducing labor costs and, you know, putting workers in their rightful place, which is subservient to capital.
Yeah, sure. The fact that the work is being replaced is one thing, but we're coming on to the point that in terms of like the reality of how AI works to replace people, there was a sort of discussion in that program about Klarna, you know, your old friends at Klarna.
Yes.
Getting rid of people, like human service agents, human support agents,
right,
to replace them with AI. And then just recently, I think in the last month, they've rolled that back because it turns out that that technology is not good enough to support the client's needs.
Right.
And so, you know, a bit of a tail between the legs there. They have to bring all the people back.
Well, not all.
No, no. Yeah. Well, I was going to say, but the trouble is that even the people that they brought them back on new contracts.
Right, exactly.
Which are more like kind of Uber driver style contracts. And I would say that Uber is a really great model, I think. It's a terrible model, but it's a really interesting model. And it's a model that it feels like is being pursued by these AI companies, which is essentially to make the workers more of a precariat.
Yes.
So that everything is basically worked on the hour, on a contract. And it's very, you know, there's no longer any concept of employees or employer relationships anymore. It's a purely transactional, and it's almost like a micro transactional relationship.
Yeah.
In fact, it is a micro transactional relationship.
It's exactly that.
That's what Uber are doing.
Yeah.
And that's how they really see the future of work, I think. And that's what it's coming. Not even I think, that's what they think.
Yeah.
That's how they think it should be.
Yeah.
And they can paint that as people having now, they've actually got their own time back. They could be an Uber driver one day, and they can work for a telephone company the next day.
Rise and grind.
You know, this Fiverr type stuff where they can, you know, they can do like a day's work as a musician. They can have all a wonderful, fulfilled life in, you know, all of the.
Everybody is now an entrepreneur, right?
Yes.
Yes.
Everybody's an entrepreneur. No one's a specialist. They're all doing different things. They're all doing what they would like to do.
Right.
Not being oppressed by some boss, actually. But in fact, it turns out that most Uber drivers are basically working as Uber drivers. They're not doing programming in their spare time doing artistry or playing the guitar or whatever.
Well, because they have no spare time, right?
They have no spare time.
And I think Uber is such a great example of exactly what the AI companies are doing, of which Uber is one, of course, right? Because the game plan is to, through automation, you know, reduce your workers to precarious workers and better yet, contractors, independent contractors, right? Who work, you know, only for you, but still they're independent contractors. And then automate them out of a job with your robo-taxis, right? Because
eventually that's the plan,
Uber has been pursuing this driverless model where it's like, okay, what we've created basically is a mechanical Turk where we have these automatons who happen to be biological running around driving cars for us.
Yeah.
All they are, you know, human robots. They will do what we want for an algorithmically set price. And then replace the human automaton with an actual automaton.
Yes, yes, yeah.
Reducing our labor costs even further.
The other thing that's really, just I want to say about Uber, which is really fascinating, is Uber are unprofitable, and they've been unprofitable. I think they've had one or two quarters of profitability by through some strange accounting techniques.
Exactly.
But they've basically been going for nearly 10 years, and it's clear that their model, without the robotics, will never be profitable.
Yep.
So it's, and of course, you know, the cost of these.
And the same for OpenAI.
The cost of these robotics is potentially also making them unprofitable.
Yeah.
So, I mean, this is the model where we're at, where somehow, and I don't understand how Uber is still alive, other than this like some cost fallacy or this brave hope that the automatons will replace the taxi drivers that they've replaced. So, you know, you have these like the Saudis, the Japanese, SoftBank, all these large investment pools still putting money into Uber, which again is losing money, just like OpenAI is losing money on this hope that it will come good, that the AGI will come good. And I think that's fundamentally what's driving this. And this is, maybe as we can come on next time around as to why this bubble might burst, because the delivery of all of these futures is not happening.
No, it is not. And I think that is probably a great place to wrap up for this week. So can't wait to talk to you next week, Ray.
Wonderful. Thanks, Josh.
Before we sign off for this week, let's take a dive into our comments section and see what you, the audience, are telling us.
I'll read this one from Oscar. Yeah, that's mint. You lot know what you're on about. I like that. Thank you very much, Oscar.
Amazing. Yeah.
There was one which I thought was very nice, very funny, from Samsky. Generative AI, more like smellerative stink eye. Great episode. Thank you, Samsky. That was really good.
Amazing. Yes. That's the kind of creativity that won't come out of a large fucking language model, that's for sure.
That's right. Absolutely. Yeah. A bit more sedate from M. O'Donohue. Thought-provoking, which I like.
Yeah.
I'll take it. I'll definitely take that.
Thoughts are good. Provoking them is better.
Chicken Infamous, which is a great name. Chicken Infamous has a lovely comment. This shit is gas, Batman. Yeah, I don't know. I think that's how the youth of today speak. I'm very happy to take it, you know?
I assume gas is the best thing that we could be.
I also assume that. I think the shit is gas. I mean, is it a methane reference? I'm not sure. Hopefully we're not polluting by doing this. But
polluting the airwaves, yeah.
Chicken Infamous is onto something there. And yeah, finally, the other one that I want to read out is this from JB. A really good discussion about the benefits and disadvantages of AI. Feels like a Lex Friedman podcast. In fact, Ray, you should get him on the show as he shares your sentiments on AI. Appreciated the Sarah Connor and Skynet reference.
Yes.
Definitely, there is no fate. So that is important. So this is really great. I think these are really nice comments, and keep them coming. It's nice to see people engaging with the show. I like a bit of fun on these comments, and also we're getting a bit of content. Keep it coming, JB. It's really nice.
Yep, and Chicken Infamous as well, of course. Want to see the chicken, yeah.
Chicken Infamous, I mean, you know, there's no stopping this guy, yeah.
person, or, you know, we don't know who Chicken Infamous is, right?
We're assuming it's actually a human or not a chicken.
Chicken is okay as long as it's not a large language model. That would be unacceptable. Get your AI slop out of our comments section if you are an AI, which I assume you're not.
This shit is Gas Batman. I don't think...
That can be an AI, right?
I don't think so.
No, that's a human or chicken. Either way, we love it. Thanks again to everyone who took time to leave us a comment. We really appreciate it. It's a lot of fun to read. If you want to get in on the action, just leave us a comment on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Send us an email, we love that. Or hit us up on socials.
This is that bit at the end where we thank you for listening to this episode of Polytechs. First, we hope you enjoyed the show, and we really appreciate the time you have given to this subject. If you want to follow up with us, please send email to podcast@polytechs.dev, because that's very direct and doesn't have any algorithms. If you prefer social media, we're at Polytechs on Blue Sky and at Polytechs at mastodon.social. We're not on Twitter for obvious reasons. To help the show reach a wider audience, please share it with your friends, family, and colleagues. There's nothing as good as a real human recommendation. You can find out more about the show on the website, which is polytechs.dev. As you should expect, there are no cookies or tracking of any kind. All the show notes, transcripts, and contact details are over there. If you want to show a deeper level of commitment, there's also an option to donate. We're passionate about free and open access to the episodes, so there's no obligation and there are no benefits other than a warm feeling in your heart. Finally, we would really appreciate a 5-star review on your podcast platform. Reading positive reviews makes us feel good and can help others find the show and make them feel like it's worth their time. Okay, that's all the admin done, and we hope to see you next week. Bye!